this is Living History. This show explores the rich heritage of the Brandywine Valley outside Philadelphia, focusing on the people, places, and events over more than 300 years which have played an important part in our American heritage. Each show highlights a local town, event, or personality who's had a notable influence on our culture. This Day in History, January 25th. In 1825, the first engineering college in the United States, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, opens to bring technical education and expertise to thousands of engineering students. RPI would later go on to become one of the most respected technical schools in the country. In 1863, Union General Fightin' Joe Hooker replaces General Ambrose P. Burnside as head of the Army of the Potomac during the Civil War. President Lincoln was desperately hoping to find a general who could crush the rebellion from the Confederate States, but would be again disappointed as Hooker was subsequently badly defeated at the Battle of Chancellorsville in May of that year. And in 1915, the very first transcontinental telephone call was made between New York and San Francisco. The telephone quickly replaced the telegraph as an efficient and effective tool for long-distance communication, transforming not only the business landscape by allowing merchants to communicate important and timely information, but revolutionizing the way people interacted, allowing persons separated by large distances to feel closer to friends and loved ones who they'd rarely spoken with or even seen before. History is not boring. It is fascinating. As an author and historian, I have focused my efforts to bring important episodes in our history to the general public, audiences of all ages, to become better informed and educated regarding our nation and its rich heritage. One local historian has been actively involved in spreading the word about our history to hundreds of audiences over the years. Kim Burdick is the director at the historic Hale Burns House in Newark, Delaware, a site which hosted General George Washington and the Marquis de Lafayette less than a week before the critical Battle of the Brandywine in September 1777. The house has an interesting heritage of its own, and Kim has worked for years to explore the history of the Northern Delaware region and its ties to Philadelphia and other important cities of the early Republic. Kim has also just written a fascinating new book, Revolutionary Delaware, which discusses many important episodes in our local history. Kim is here with us today to discuss her work, her many projects, and her new book. Kim, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Gene. How are you?
Well, welcome, and Happy New Year. I'm doing just great, and I'm so glad you could be on the show. Tell us a little bit about your responsibilities at the historic Hale Burns House.
Well, Hale Burns House is it's actually a rental property. It belongs to the state. It's managed by a 501c3 nonprofit, and Ralph and I rent it from the nonprofit. So it's a three-legged stool. It's one of the best resident curatorships in the country, actually. And my title, I guess, is manager.
Mm-hmm. And you are? Do you also hold the hat of a curator of the property and the different artifacts?
Oh, I'm the chief cook and bottle washer, and we have a very active board here. So it's a very good place. Good volunteers, good board.
And how long have you been at Hale Burns?
We came in 2008.
Mm-hmm. And had you expressed an interest in the house before? What brought it to your attention?
Well, I've always known about it long, long ago. Warner Naudane used to be the chairman of the board here, and he was also the chairman of the Delaware Huguenot Society. So I used to come to Huguenot meetings here. Mm. So I've always been aware of it and always been very interested in it.
Sure. Now, just tell us a little bit about the history of the structure itself. When was it built, and what was its role in the American Revolution?
Well, it was built circa 1750, and we don't really know truly if the centerpiece of the house where we hold our meetings was the original house or built on that property. The best documented part comes about 1750, and David Finney of David Finney Inn in historic Newcastle owned this property 1750 to about 1773 when he sold it to Daniel Burns, who is the Burns part of the name. Mm. And Daniel Burns was a known Quaker pacifist. He was an early abolitionist And he also was clerk of Wilmington Friends Meeting and part of the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting. So when he came over here in 1773 with his family, including a number of children and a wife, his idea was that this was a perfect location for sort of a satellite campus for Brandywine Village's milling community. It's where the Red and White Clay Creek come together right in the backyard here and flow into the Christina and then into the Delaware. And it was, in its day, also a T-shaped intersection going from Baltimore straight up to Lancaster, Lancaster Limestone Road.
Mm-hmm.
And also it went east and west from here to the Maryland line, coming out at Iron Hill into Elk Creek. And the Battle of Cooch's Bridge kind of put us on the map. It's about 3.5 miles southwest of the Hale Burns house. And Battle of Cooch's Bridge, September 3rd, Battle of the Brandywine, September 11th, 1777. In the middle of that, a knock came on the door here at this Quaker pacifist house, a staff person of George Washington saying, So, Mr. Quaker pacifist, sir, we are having a council of war at your house at 5. See you around. It's kind of one of the things that interests me the most is how Quakers were not involved in the war. They weren't allowed to by their faith, and yet they're kind of imposed upon, and sometimes they're interested, and sometimes they're violently opposed to it.
Well, I've done a bit of research on Quakers in the Longwood area, Kennett Square, Longwood area, and some Quakers actually picked up rifles and fought, and where they were actually in the militia. Now, I understand there are some questions about, you know, whether you were listed on the militia just simply because they wanted to get names on there and they wanted to have, you know, a long list of, quote, volunteers, or whether they were actively involved. But I believe there is evidence that some Quakers actually fought in the Revolution.
Well, they did, including Nathaniel Green of Rhode Island.
Yes.
And Clement Biddle, who, you know, Biddles are a big name in this area anyways,
yes.
But they were called fallen Quakers, and they got kicked out of their meetings. And
right.
Some of them rejoined the faith later after the war, but it was a very controversial time period and very frightening time period.
Absolutely. I believe your site is on what is now called the W3R Trail. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, what that really means is Washington, Rochambeau, Revolutionary Route. That's the three R's. It was named by a couple of old guys up in Connecticut before I got involved.
Mm-hmm.
What it really is a Yorktown campaign trail. And it begins in Newport, Rhode Island, and comes south through 9 states and what is now D.C. to Yorktown, Virginia, where in October of 1781, the Allied French and American forces defeated British General Cornwallis. And the Pennsylvania part of the route is actually pretty small. It comes across from New Jersey, Philadelphia, and then down to Darby and Chester, Wilmington, Christiana Bridge, Iron Hill, and then over to the Head of Elk. So it's a piece of a larger puzzle that includes all the 9 states that are between Rhode Island and Virginia.
And what is the plan to develop or kind of put markers there? What's the progress on that?
Well, we put markers all along the route. You will see them, including in Chester and Darby, but all through Delaware. The 26-mile piece at Delaware has. Currently, there are shield-shaped highway route markers that have red and white stripes and a blue block with a fleur-de-lis on it. Currently, it's a public-private partnership with the National Park Service. So all the states and municipalities that have this stretch of road going through their towns are all helping each other. And just at the moment, we're trying to replace the faded 2006 installation with updated route markers that have a logo that was designed by the Park Service to indicate that this is indeed a National Historic Trail.
Do you know if it comes through part of Chester County?
Yeah, it comes right through Chester, but it doesn't go too far west. This was a known route that people were walking, so it's it goes through Derby and Chester and Philly, and that's about it. There are other routes involved in the Revolutionary War, but not necessarily the Yorktown Campaign Trail. Mm-hmm. Philadelphia campaign of a few years earlier, of 1777, is west and more over your way.
Yes. Tell us a little bit about the activities you have there, different events at the Hale Burns House.
Well, of course, we're closed in the winter, but we open again in April. There, this is at the confluence of three rivers, actually, the Red, the White, and the Christina. And so there are a lot of fishermen, kayaks, canoes come over and past here. But on Saturday evenings, once a month, we host the American Revolution Roundtable of Northern Delaware. And there are a couple of these in Pennsylvania. The one that I usually go to is the one up in Fort Washington that's called Our Top, and Jim mm-hmm. Christ has another one mm-hmm. in Paoli. So mm-hmm. there, it's a network of people who are interested in the Revolutionary War. And, of course, you spoke at one of them here.
Mm-hmm.
But we bring in authors and scholars and reenactors and try very hard to make Hale Burns House a community gathering place, because Staunton, Delaware doesn't really have a focal point anymore because the roads chopped it all up.
Yes. I've been to the Hale Burns House several times, including a couple of presentations. Tell our listeners just a little bit about the different artifacts and displays you have there at the house.
Not too much in terms of displays, because we're really registered as an historic site, not as a museum. But we do have a few good pieces, and the keeping room, we call it, was a 1773 edition that has a nice walk-in fireplace and the fireplace equipment and so forth. Mostly we're focused on telling the story, not as being a historic house museum, but we really encourage people to come. It's only open as a museum a couple hours a month. On the first Wednesday at lunchtime of each month, it's open. People can come and look. But it's really an active place, but it's active more as a place to learn about history and about the environment than as a historic house museum.
Very interesting. You have been given a lot of awards, I can see, a lot of certifications and awards from the area, including the Preservation 50 State of Delaware in recognition for efforts to promote the 50th anniversary of the National Historic Preservation Laws, and many, many other recognition efforts over the years. Tell us about your activities that have gained you these awards.
Oh, wow.
Or just maybe perhaps just one or two.
Well, little Miss La-di-da, right? mm-hmm. My efforts as a national coordinator of the W3R, back in the days of the 225th anniversary of the Yorktown campaign, which was in 2006, involved coordinating activities in 9 states and also lobbying Congress to make this a National Historic Trail. And that was very successful and the springboard to a lot of other things. And for that, the French government, in the days of the Great French Fry Wars, if you remember how unpleasant those were, they were very relieved and very helpful. So mm-hmm. I received a Palmes Academique from the French ambassador and French consul general to the United States for those efforts of telling the French story of its assistance in the American Revolution. And the other things, I was for 9 years on the Board of Advisors of the National Trust, and so I coordinated this past year, 2006, is the 50th anniversary of the preservation law. So we met in locations all through the state, bringing people to the table to talk about their own preservation projects and interests and needs. And that was really fun. And then The new thing that I just got was Communicator of Achievement from Delaware Press Association. So it's all very nice, but, you know, it's just because when I believe in something, I just do it.
Excellent. We're going to take a brief break, but stay with us. We'll be back with Kim Burdick, author of Revolutionary Delaware. This is Living History. Burdick, author of Revolutionary Delaware, and this is Living History. I'm Gene Pasale. Kim, you have been very actively involved in a lot of projects over the years, but one I noticed on your resume is that you were involved with the Delaware Memorial at Gettysburg. So this is the next big war, the Civil War. Tell us a little bit about the Delaware Memorial.
Oh, that's a nice project. That was quite a while ago, 2002, I think, but we were the only state that did not have a marker on the battlefield at Gettysburg, and we were the last to be allowed to put anything up there. But Delaware was kind of a border state. The northern part of Delaware, very much Yankee. The southern part, because we're on the Delmarva Peninsula, and the southern part of the state is attached to Virginia and Maryland, so the southern part, more Confederate. And so our effort was to get a top drawer sculptor, Ron Tunison, to make us a statue. And it's a bas relief. It shows the Delaware troops on the wheat field at Gettysburg. And it was a nice event. They had Senator Steve Amick, who's long retired, but he lives in Newark, is very involved in the Newark Historical Society in Delaware. He knew Ken Burns from when they were young.
Oh, they were friends.
They were, and he got Ken Burns to come and be the keynote speaker. So it was kind of a big deal, but it was a good way to get the word out about Delaware and its mixed role in the American Civil War.
Now, were you physically there when they installed the marker at Gettysburg?
Oh, yeah. I was there when we had the... we called in a number of different sculptors and architects to be on the committee, and they had maquettes made. They're like models of what they thought would work for their statue. So I was there from the beginning of the legislators getting the idea that they wanted to do it, all the way through. I was the project director of that effort.
Excellent. I love Gettysburg. In fact, as an historian and just a longtime student of history, I first was very interested in the Civil War and then kind of gravitated towards the early Republic and the Revolutionary War because I live in Chester County, which, as you know, is quite important in that effort. But I just think it's fascinating. By the way, for our listeners, if you have not been to Gettysburg and you enjoy history, you absolutely should go there. It is by far the most fascinating and best illustrated and best marked battlefield in the United States.
And it's very beautiful.
It is a beautiful place. I love Gettysburg. The town itself is charming. The Farnsworth House Tavern is wonderful with great food there, and it's just a lovely place. I know you're involved also with the George Washington Society. Tell us a little bit about your efforts there.
Well, there are two, and if somebody Googles that, the one with a nice website is not us.
Okay.
We do have a Facebook page. The one out west is very different than ours. Ours was originally kind of a gentleman's antiquarian society, and I'm the first woman that was ever allowed to be on their board, and now I've been their president for a long time. Very focused on scholarship, fellowship, and good food.
Yes, I have been to a few of your meetings, and as a living biographer of Alexander Hamilton, I would love to give that presentation there someday.
No, you can't do it there. That's all about George, but you can do it at Hale Burns' house at the round table.
Okay, I'll do it at Hale Burns again.
Yes, you will. People loved your talk.
Well, thank you.
At the George Washington Society, we typically have speakers from the University of Virginia because they're digitalizing all of George Washington's and now Martha Washington's primary documents, and Nancy Loney of the Valley Forge Historical Society, and Edward Langle is coming back. He was one of the editors of the George Washington papers, and currently he's the head of the White House Historical Society. So it's
He's a fascinating guy. We've traded emails a few times.
Well, he's a very good speaker, as you are. But
thank you.
The George Washington Society really focuses on George.
Well, that's the way it should be, by the way, for our greatest president. It should be focused on him. You have just written a fascinating new book, Revolutionary Delaware. One, what inspired you to write the book? And tell us a little bit about the story that you tell.
Well, when I moved here in 2008, of course, I've always been a historian and interested in this stuff, but I got really interested in the idea that the house was saved because George Washington was here, but it was a Quaker house.
Yes.
And I started to do a lot of reading about the Philadelphia campaign of 1777, and that's the piece that includes Chester County, not the Yorktown campaign so much, but Philadelphia campaign. The goal of the British was to capture Philadelphia, the rebel stronghold. And so I kept reading all these books. Didn't matter how fabulous the scholar was or how young and interesting and wonderful the scholar was, they all say the same thing. They all say the British came up the head of Elk, and a few days later they fought at Chad's Ford. My thought was, well, beam me up, Scotty, how'd they get there? Because, you know, you can't go from Maryland to Chad's Ford, mostly, unless you go through Delaware.
Exactly.
And what I found is that most of the records about what happened in Delaware are actually in British and in Hessian journals and letters home. There's really not that much about it in other records, because we were the lower three counties of Pennsylvania.
Yes.
And we weren't even our own state, so we get kind of morphed into what goes on in the Historical Society of Pennsylvania.
Now, did you have to check original or primary documents in any English or British sources?
It's mostly everything, you know, is easily found digitalized online these days. Everything is, well, of course, Delaware Historical Society has good records. Pennsylvania does. The special collections at the University of Delaware. But almost everything that I wrote about is backed up with primary resources because the secondary sources really don't bother to mention Delaware too much.
Right. And in terms of your research, did you get a chance, perhaps at the University of Delaware or Delaware Historical Society, to actually see a hard copy of manuscripts and books from the period?
Oh, sure. Yeah. And many artifacts as well.
What most impressed you, or what did you find most interesting about the primary documents or manuscripts you saw? What kept stuck in your mind that was most important?
Well, a lot of different things. Of course, I liked seeing Robert Kirkwood's signature. The thing that really blew my mind was two things. One, I knew Philander Chase, who was one of the earlier University of Virginia editors of the digitalized George Washington papers. And just really to make Phil happy and see what was going on, I typed in on the search line Daniel Burns, and up popped Daniel Burns in a letter that he had written to George Washington saying, I was the owner of the mills in Delaware.
You
can tell how he talks because it's very phonetic writing.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing at Swarthmore, I don't know if you know, but it's worth going to their college library. When you go up the steps and you turn left, that whole wing is a Quaker Historical Society.
I have done research there many times. I know the curator there as well.
Well, it's awesome. And there, most of the local Quaker meetings gave their primary documents to Swarthmore for safekeeping.
And the Friends Library.
Yeah. So when you go there, you can actually hold like the Book of Sufferings, where the Quakers kept lists of what was taken from them. We know, 600 bales of hay were taken from right up the road here, or that a case a chest on chest was taken out of this house. We know so much because they weren't allowed to charge. They weren't allowed to participate, but they did keep lists tracking what happened here. And those things are pretty fascinating when you think somebody who was living through these horrible things was actually writing it, and you're allowed to handle these things. So it's sort of like their writing goes through your fingers up to your brain in a shockwave.
It's a great way to get a firsthand in touch with history. And I've done research there several times, and in fact spoken with the curator on numerous occasions. In fact, even had him on the show once. How important, in your view, was Delaware in the American Revolution? What place does it hold?
I think it's more important than people know. I have to admit, when I first got married, I lived in Jeffersonville up in Montgomery County. I really didn't know where Delaware was, and nobody I knew where Delaware was. You know, we knew Winterthur, we knew Hagley, we knew Concord Pike, where you could get a cheap dishwasher or a refrigerator or something.
Yes.
And that's kind of where it shut off in our brains. Because up mm-hmm. there, you know, we didn't go to the Delaware beaches. They went to the Jersey Shore.
Right.
And
yeah.
So it's kind of an invisible place for many in Pennsylvania. And yet, many of our revolutionary figures, Thomas McCain and John Dickinson, they served as important public officials on both sides of the line.
Yes.
And many people had homes up there and also country homes down here. So it's McCain and Dickinson are probably the most important ones. They were the thinkers. They were the fighters. Thomas McCain, of course, an angry Scots-Irishman. He grew up just south of Avondale and then lived in Newcastle. But it was all one area. It wasn't two separate states like it is now.
I've been to the site where McCain's house was standing.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Dickinson, obviously an early, a vociferous opponent of actually declaring independence, and then finally decided to sign the Declaration.
Well, more than that, you know, his letters from a farmer in Pennsylvania, he's Delaware's John Dickinson. He was complaining, he was writing, he was protesting in 1767 about they should not be making laws that don't involve us because we had no representation in Parliament. He almost, in some ways, triggered the war.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he wouldn't sign the Declaration, he actually joined the Kent County Militia. So mm-hmm. He's not as namby-pamby as you would think.
Yes, oh, absolutely, I agree.
He just didn't think the timing was right to break away from England. He thought they should fight. The principle of the thing was that we had no representation in Parliament, and what Parliament was doing was wrong.
That's right. Sadly, many people are what I call history deficient. They just don't know their own history. Do you, through your books and lectures and different activities, do you try to instill a love of history in your audiences?
Well, sure. I think, you know, it's like when you go on a walking tour or a bus tour or something. Like, if you went to Italy, for example, you know, there's stuff you don't know, but if you have a tour guide and they're saying, now notice the dental moldings and pointing up with their fingers looking at the roof line, you see things you never saw before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's not that they're not interested, it's just that nobody ever pointed out the cool stuff before.
Yes, I agree. Can people buy your book on Amazon, and how can they get personally signed copies?
Well, you can always come to one of our programs and bring your book, and I'll sign it.
Can they contact you directly at the Hale Burns House if they want you to mail them a signed copy?
Well, I wouldn't mail them a copy because they can actually get them cheaper on Amazon.
But
I could, if they contact me through the Hale Burns website. I could send a book plate that I signed.
Excellent.
And I could personalize it, so sure.
Excellent. And thank you for the copy you sent me. I treasure it, and I will keep it as part of my research library. Finally, we're just about to finish up. What is the outlook for historic sites like the Hale Burns House, and do you hope to get any grants or government funding for additional preservation?
Sure, of course. In fact, you know, the house is an 18th century brick house, and it suffered a lot of damage in both the north and the south gable end, so that the attic floor actually looks like a sandbox, kind of, where the bricks are just crumbling into dust. So I'm really happy to say that we just got more than $47,000 grant to repair these gable ends. So
excellent.
People are interested. People aren't drawing back, and we don't know what will happen in this new administration. But sometimes when citizens are nervous and upset and worried, sometimes they cling to the past more. But also, there have been a number of really wonderful studies, especially by Donovan Ripkema, but also by Stephanie Meeks of the Trust, that are showing how places that are revitalized, old buildings are used, it's a people scale, better than these modern huge glass office complexes.
And absolutely.
That, it's proven that it's economically beneficial.
Well, it's beneficial for the whole community.
Beneficial.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, Kim, thank you so much for being with us on the show today. It was just a great pleasure speaking with you, and I haven't delved into your book yet, but I will soon.
Okay,
be sure.
And I'm on a book report.
yes, I certainly will, and I'll stop by the Hale Burns one of these days. Be sure to tune in next Wednesday, February 1st at 1 p.m., when Lili Gaylor, a local artist, will be my guest host talking about art and art history. Thank you all for joining us today for Living History.